Welcome to the Heal, Thrive, Dream podcast, where trauma survivors become healthy thrivers. Each month, we'll feature a theme in the trauma recovery and empowerment field to promote your recovery, healing, and learning how to build dreams. Here's your host, Karen Robinson, transformational coach and therapist.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Heal, Thrive, Dream podcast. Today, our guest is Jocelyn Williams. Jocelyn today is going to talk to us about her previous position as an investigator. And she also has a book that she's going to share with us today. And Jocelyn, I know I didn't do your bio the justice that it needs. So please fill in the gaps for us.
Okay. So my name is Jocelyn Williams. I am from Greensboro, North Carolina, and currently reside here in Charlotte, North Carolina. I played college basketball and graduated from Mars Hill College in Asheville and got my sociology degree and obtained my MSW from Our Lady of the Lake University, which is in Texas, which is exciting. So far, I have most of my background deals with child welfare. I've worked a lot at group homes with at-risk youth. I've worked in mental health agencies and taught DBT, dialectical behavior therapy. I worked at a juvenile detention center. And like you said, Karen, my recent job was as a forensic investigation supervisor. And I did that for 4 years. And author of So Your Work, like you said, sorry.
What's the name of the book one more time?
So Your Work.
All right, and we'll have a link to that in the show notes for anyone who would like to purchase that to support Jocelyn. So Jocelyn, was your position as the investigative supervisor, was that the hardest one in your career so far?
Yes, by far. So
you thought you were like, oh, well, maybe it was easy for her. I don't know.
No, I had a flashback. So originally, when I began to be a forensic investigation social worker, I started off as that. I did that for a year and was promoted as a supervisor within my first year and made employee of the year. I had no clue what I was getting myself into. The stereotype of what I heard of a social worker, what a social worker was, is different than what I actually experienced when I first became there at that job. And it was, it's my most rewarding job as far as the people that I have helped and what really goes on in the world that people don't really talk about or that you see sporadically on the news. But it's also a job that allowed me to look internally within myself to make sure that I took care of myself due to the things that I was seeing on a daily basis, and just kind of having that realization of what, like I said, what actually goes on in the world. It's the toughest job that I had. It's the best job that I had. It's the most enlightening job that I've had. And it's the most exhausting job that I've had as well.
Yeah, so being a social worker alone is pretty fatiguing, because most social workers don't become a social worker for any kind of financial reason. It's to give back, make a difference. You know, we have big hearts usually.
Exactly.
And so then we get fatigued. And so I can imagine doing something has a lot of trauma involved in it is even more exhausting. So we're going to do a little bit of just a heads up or trigger warning. Some of the discussion today may be a little challenging if you are a child abuse survivor. And so I'm not sure how much Jocelyn will share, but what I would like you to do, Jocelyn, if you're comfortable, is just kind of walk us through maybe a typical hard day on the job. Is that something you could do for us today?
I can. It's a lot. I'm trying to figure out what's the best story to tell. I'll share my hardest day as far as what has really inspired me to talk more to people about my job as far as self-care and inspired me to write Soul Your Work as well. So trigger warning, for sure. So there was an incident where we had a case where a young child had passed away, and myself and the detectives, per what their policy is and what they have to do what they call a reenactment video. And because I worked for DSS and I was investigating what happened to that child, I had to be present to make more sense out of what happened so we could figure out how we wanted to rule that case, which is substantiated, which means that there was some fault within the parent, or to unsubstantiated, which means it was an accident, it had nothing to do with them, things of that sort. So on that specific day, I went to the parent's house with law enforcement, and they had a videographer there, and they had a fake infant because it was a, I believe it was a 3-month-old that had passed away. And they had the mom reenact what happened that day. That was the first time that I seen it. And immediately, as a social worker, if I'm hearing it, I'm like, why would you ask her to do the worst thing and reenact the worst thing that has happened to her in her life? And it was very tough to watch. I personally had to step away, but I had to be present enough to make sure that I collected the information that I needed, as well as far as, you know, my case and obtaining, you know, doing my job at the end of the day. But watching her do that, she had her father there at the time, and he was trying to be as supportive as he could. But of course, that was his granddaughter, and it was extremely traumatic for her. And for me watching it, even though it has nothing, it doesn't hold a candle up to what her actual trauma was. And when I left that day, I just decided to go home. I was exhausted. It was too much for me to handle. I've never seen that before. I get that people see it on a daily basis because it's part of their job. But due to the fact that I'm not desensitized of what happens with the human because of my job, which I think is important with social workers, when we come to sensitize things, we need to leave. But because it really impacted me, I needed to take that day off. And I believe I actually took the next day off as well to take care of myself, to make sure that I wasn't internalizing what had happened. And it helped me find different ways to separate the job from personal, which is easier said than done. And again, that was part of the reason inspired me to write Soul Your Work, because we deal with secondhand trauma every day, and people don't know how to handle it. They don't know how to address it. And there's not necessarily a bunch of resources for us to handle that when we go home at the end of the day.
Right. Okay. So DSS was already previously involved with this family. Is that why you were part of the investigation?
No. So, and I guess I should have touched on this earlier. So as the forensic investigation supervisor, my unit was a specialized unit, and we had all the tough, high profile cases within that county. So any major substance abuse case, any major human trafficking case, any major fatality case, any meth labs, any major domestic violence cases, we dealt with. So it was a majority of sex abuse cases, high profile sex abuse cases, high profile fatality cases. We had some where we've had multiple that have been on the news, and I believe one is even in the process of being a Lifetime movie. So we got involved because that's what my unit specializes in.
Okay. Yeah. Heal, Thrive, Dream. We do a certain proceed of our revenue goes to A21, which works with human trafficking, so which is It's really mind-blowing how much it's in our areas where we live. Like, everyone thinks it just happens overseas.
Mm-mm. It's in your back door.
Yeah, it's a huge problem in the States. Is that something else you could share, let's say, like what that was like in those cases for you?
So, I mean, pretty much like I said, as far as the secondhand trauma and having to continuously interact with those parents to ask them those tough questions as far as what happened, what kind of drugs were you using, what's your past trauma, what's your past history, how do you deal with stress? We're going in your house and, you know, taking videos, taking pictures, and seeing things happen that way. But one of the best resources that we had and that still exists now is called the CAC, which is called the Child Advocacy Center. So outside of DSS and social workers just coming in to investigate cases, we want to ensure that our clients have actual help outside of us, outside of our initial interaction. So the whole purpose of the CAC is where kids are interviewed at. It's a child-friendly interview. They're not like interrogating anybody. It's led by that child. So whatever they want to say is pretty much open to them. It's not like they're being, you know, held in contempt or anything like that. And they actually have resources to support victims of human trafficking, of sex abuse, of domestic violence. So again, once we get finished with our investigation, they can get that continuous help. But unfortunately, every CAC isn't the same. Every CAC doesn't have the support of the community. Every community doesn't understand how often children are sexually abused or physically abused, emotionally abused. It's more of the culture where I worked at in that county. It didn't happen to me. I don't really see it and hear about it, but just because it's not present doesn't mean that it doesn't actually happen, and doesn't mean that that these people don't actually need that support at the end of the day. It's just a whole lot. A lot of people, the hardest thing that I had to deal with at DSS was understanding that some people's trauma is generational. So where it seems like it's just your normal day to day, this is what happened to my mom, so my daughter shouldn't be upset because I got it worse when I was younger. That mentality and how that births, you know, continuous cases and families dealing with the same thing over and over again is very traumatic. And it was very difficult to see, because as a social worker, we know at the end of the day that everybody has the right to self-determination. You can give them the resources. You can show them what to do. You can drive them there and drop them off unless they are willing and want to actually make that change. They can or they can't, and you have to be okay with that at the end of the day, which is by far the toughest pill that I've had to swallow, because I've seen clients continue to go down that go downhill. But what I've learned is, as long as I've done my best and I've given the best resources that I could and the best advice that I could, and I didn't add on through that trauma consciously or unconsciously, then I can, you know, pat myself on the back at the end of the day. Despite what happens to them, at the end of the day, we have to take care of ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes when people go downhill, they eventually come back to us anyway. We usually get another opportunity, hopefully, if they are still alive, right?
For sure. The great thing about it is normally when DSS comes in or a social worker come in, you know, a lot of people see it as invasive, because like I said, we are in their house and asking questions, and we get a lot of backlash. I've been called every name in the book and names that I've never heard of before. However, how I interact with my clients, and when I explain to them what my job is, instead of just doing it, it makes it better. So I've had a bunch of clients that we were clashing heads at the beginning, and by the end, even when that case is closed, they still calling me and saying, hey, let me send you a picture of little Johnny. Let me tell you how great he's doing now. And that is by far the best thing that, you know, that keeps me going at the end of the day, because when you see it go from zero to 100 in a positive light, it's like, okay, I really truly did my job. Unfortunately, that's not the same for every person, but I would say probably gratefully at least 95% of the families that I've interacted with has came back and, you know, told me a great story, or if their case went to another unit, they would say, hey, like, can I get Jocelyn? Like, where is she at? And then when I became a supervisor, I'm like, I can't come to your house and investigate cases anymore. I can talk to my worker about what you have going on. Granted, I have done a couple follow-up visits for my unit. I was a very hands-on supervisor, and I understand that it's very stressful and your mind just isn't right. And I was that type of supervisor to say, hey, okay, what house were you supposed to go to at 3 o'clock? I'll go for you and have that interaction. And plus, you know, as a worker, they're coming to give me information. Sometimes I want to see it myself so I can get that feel, so I can talk to that parent, so they can explain things to me. So at the end of the day, I can make sure that I'm making the right decision when my workers were staffing cases with me and telling me what was going on.
Right. Now, I think you said something really key. Like, if clients understand that we're not there to create havoc or give them another problem, we're there to help them find solutions. Like, we want to be helpful. That's the bottom line, was we want to help families.
For sure.
For sure. Protect children.
For sure. And I think going back to what I was saying earlier with the generational curses, a lot of them have already dealt with social workers in the past. And sometimes I hear them say, well, the last social worker I had, she was disrespectful. She cursed at me. She said she was coming to my house at 4:00. She would show up 30 minutes late. And I'm like, look, I understand. I can't say that that doesn't exist, because I know some of these people that you're explaining. All I can tell you is that this is how I work. This is how I operate. Feel free to call me out if I do something wrong or that's offensive, because again, your perspective is your reality. How you view things may not be the same as me, but I'll at least want you to know, you know, what's my standpoint and where I'm coming from, which is why I like to explain things to my client. If they don't understand things from my perspective, I bring it up to my supervisor and their supervisor. There's been plenty of times, especially with high profile cases, we've had to get legal in, or I would have to call a client with legal beside me so I can make sure that, you know, like I said, at the end of the day, I'm protected, and then it's protecting the client at the same time, so they can have, you know, their legal representation to make sure that that everything is okay. But I do want to touch on, as far as the impact and clients not necessarily understanding things, what I've seen is the victims from trauma specifically don't understand stuff, especially children. So when it comes to, you know, sex abuse or domestic violence, look, I talk about sex abuse specifically. If the person is your dad, you know, someone that is, he loves you, he protects you, he's making sure that you eat every day, that you have a roof over your head, and he's giving you those essentials. Sometimes they can put the sexual abuse to the backside because he's doing what he's supposed to do as a dad. And then when they realize, when that light bulb goes off, that what has been happening this whole time that I thought was okay is not, it is crushing to, yeah, to these kids. So again, to follow up with the impact once that light bulb goes off with places like, you know, the CAC, the Child Advocacy Center, and other therapy organizations that we refer people to, that part is absolutely essential. However, we do have those parents that once something comes out, they want to confine it. They don't want anybody else to know. They don't want to bring it to therapists. They don't trust therapists. They don't believe that they need to talk about it. They don't believe that it was that serious. they are in denial themselves about what happened, about leaving their child at home while they work third shift with dad or mom or uncle or auntie. It's like, it's the follow through of the help that these victims need is the toughest part, because again, we can give them the resources, but when you're at home and you're a child and you can't get in the car and go to a therapy session yourself, you can't drive yourself to a therapy session yourself. What do? You know, if your dad is doing something to you and your mom refuses to believe you, where are you going to go as a child if your dad lives in a home, you know? And that's, again, that's one of those tough things at the end of the day. And that's why it's important to have a village. So, you know, if the mom isn't quite understanding something or protecting that child, you have that aunt or that uncle that's like, look, like, let me take little Johnny for a couple of weeks and figure out what's going on. Let's make a plan. Because the scary thing is, to be honest with you, sometimes when DSS isn't involved, once we close a case, it goes right back to what it was before, or sometimes even worse, because we're revealing things now. Right. Now things are at the forefront, and we have had, you know, times where children were retaliated against, or, you know, you go to a school and you try to talk to them and they are afraid to look your way because your face is, you're the person that brought this to light. It hurt me before, but I'm more hurt now that it's, that is at the forefront. So do I continue to talk to you? Do I continue to take that risk of adding on more trauma to my life? Or will I just go back to what it was, because I'm realizing that it wasn't as bad as it was before I saw you, Jocelyn. So it's a whole lot.
It is a whole lot for the children and for us, especially if there's not enough evidence, you know, and there's not much we can do in those cases.
Yes.
It gets to be really, really challenging.
Very challenging. And the evidence part is probably, I would say for sure, the biggest thing, because if you don't have something physical, you would want physical evidence, you would want a child to, you know, make a disclosure. But again, if they've been threatened, if they're afraid, if they don't want to be sent off, if they don't want it to happen again, you have to make a choice whether you want to disclose that information or not. And to be honest, you know, thinking from a child's point of view, it's a no-brainer. I'm not going to say anything. Oh, or if I don't say anything, I'm going to get ice cream at the end of the day. We had a situation like that. And it's like, as a child, you think ice cream is that important. But as you grow up and you realize the reality of what happened, it takes you by storm. And sometimes it can be, it can completely change your life 360.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, so really hard discussion. And it sounds like you have really taken to heart self-care and taking care of yourself during your social work journey. And honestly, a lot of social workers aren't so good at that. And I even can say for myself that I've had some really low points on taking care of myself and then some better points on taking care of myself as a social worker. So we would love to hear your tips, like not only how you took care of yourself, but also if you have tips on how survivors, you know, the career woman that listened to the show who had trauma in their childhood or domestic violence or both sexual, any ideas for them on your favorite self-care tools, things that you know can make a difference?
So what I've learned, the biggest thing is boundaries. It sounds cliche, but it's true, especially when it comes to, again, just being a social worker in general. People can call you all day and what's a fire to them may not necessarily be a fire to you. But because, again, as social workers, we have that heart, we want to help. We just extend ourselves over and over and over again. And when that happened to me specifically, I kept, I was getting headaches and I was nauseous daily. But the funny thing is when I got home, I was fine. It would only happen when I was on my way to work. I went to the doctor and everything. Nobody could figure out what, and I wrote about it in Soya Work as well. Nobody could figure out what was wrong with me, but I was overexhausting myself. I was internalizing other people's problems and making it my own. And then when I got home, I got to breathe. But after I did that one breath, I was like, okay, what was going on with this case? Like, what do I need to do tomorrow? How far behind am I on these case notes? Like, what is court going to be like on this day? Am I going to be in there all day and it's going to interfere with me doing my documentation? Will I get a case tomorrow? I'm already behind. And it was a constant type of just gerbil wheel of things that I have no control over at the end of the day. So making sure that when I got home, I wasn't watching intervention or things like that that would relate to stuff that I had going on at work, it absolutely made it worse. That's what my interest is in, but I learned that I had to turn it off when I got home, especially immediately after work. So my favorite thing to do now is to watch like comedy, stand-ups, sometimes podcasts. Like I like watching like self-care, like enlightening things, like Think Like a Monk or some stuff from Issa Rae, just to see how successful she is. Has nothing to do with children or sex abuse or nothing in nothing.
No SVU.
Yeah. I love that. I love that. And I'm like, well, Jocelyn, why would you not go home and do things that you enjoy? But I realized that unconsciously it was adding on to the trauma that I just endured that day. So pretty much boundaries, creating boundaries, turning things off, not answering clients when it's 5 o'clock, because you have that tendency to check that email or you get that text from that client and it's like, if I send this one text, it'll be fine. Little do you know, an hour later, because they're going to say something else that's intriguing, especially if it's a case that you want to figure out, and then you're down a rabbit hole at the end of the day. So creating boundaries, finding things to do that has nothing to do with your job. And at the end of the day, just being grateful. Again, that sounds simple, but being able to go to a home that's yours, if you do have your own place, or just having a space to clear your mind and just be grateful for the things that you have and the gift that you have with the clients that you are helping out, that really helped me. On top of my, what I've been doing my whole life is exercise. I put my headphones on and I'm just sweating it out. I get angry sometimes that stuff that has happened at work. Law enforcement may not take a case, or we didn't have enough evidence. Like you said, if I need to get some type of energy out, I need to do it in a productive way. So what better way than to take care of my temple and my mind at the same time, which exercise does for me, as well as meditation. As far as clients, again, the biggest thing is having that village. Unfortunately, and I hate to say this, as far as children and who they talk to and who they lean on, it is not their parents. It is always a aunt, a uncle, a best friend that's very close to them. It's a teacher. And whether it doesn't matter who it is, as long as you have that one person or two people to make sure that you can talk to unfiltered. If you have something that you want to say, it's not like you are hesitant on what comes out of your mouth. You just allow it to fly openly. And if you don't have a person like that, one of my favorite things to do is journaling. It's between me, myself, and I. I'm writing it down. That's my way of releasing it and getting it off my chest at the end of the day. Sometimes after I write things down, I'll read it again out loud to make it live in my head, and then I can kind of figure things out myself. The worst thing that you can do is just internalizing it and believing that going to sleep or ignoring it is going to fix whatever the issue is. That's not going to do that at the end of the day. And if you don't have either one of those, if you don't like journaling, if you have the resource to go to therapy, to talk to somebody that you trust that, you know, won't allow your information to get out or won't judge you or post things on Instagram or Facebook like people do nowadays, that is definitely an essential tool. But again, at the end of the day, don't internalize it or place your trauma on somebody else, because that's not fair at the end of the day either. We want to make sure that everybody is healed and take care of themselves, but it requires you to do the work yourself first.
Wow. So Jocelyn, you may be the most mentally healthy person I've spoken to today. Exercise, journaling, meditation.
This is my favorite thing. It and people ask me all the time, they think, oh, Jocelyn is, you know, so chill. She has the answers to everything. No, I have fell on my face 1,018 times. The great thing about it is my resiliency is A1, is 100%. So whether I have a bad day, I know that I have the potential to, you know, pick myself up at the end of the day. I recognize that life is hard for everybody, whether you have money, whether you're poor, whether you're Black, whether you're white, life does not discriminate. And I don't want to victimize myself to things that are out of my control. Like, it's inevitable that something bad is going to happen. However, my tool belt with my resources is everlasting, and I continue to fix that and alter that as I grow and mature, because what worked for me 5 years ago may not work for me now.
So one of my favorite questions to ask my guests is what books are you reading now, and or what book has really inspired you along your journey?
So I just recently, I feel terrible saying this. My favorite book I just read a month ago, and I've read a lot of books in my life. I think I need to go back in my arsenal and make sure that this is my favorite, but it really blew me away. It's called The Untethered Soul.
Oh, it's good.
Michael.
I read that book too a while ago.
Michael something.
Yeah.
That's terrible. When I Google it, it's only one Untethered Soul. So that book, again, I just read it. I read about a month or two ago, and the perspective on life and how you just holding that mirror up at the end of the day and looking at yourself is so essential. Because in life, we're sitting here trying to control other people. They did this to me. They should be held accountable. No, you cannot. If we could control other people, the world would be a better place. But we can't do that. We can only control ourselves. And the way that he breaks it down and how he talks about basically internalizing things and how you have the power to, you know, alternate things and change your mindset as to how things affect you, it's like the perfect recipe for a social worker, because we're dealing with other people's problems all day. So what better way to figure out how to not, you know, internalize that or make it part of us? And what better way for us to figure out how to take care of ourselves? But immediately after I read the first chapter, I took a picture of the first page and put it in my group chat with my family and my best friends. And I posted it on my Instagram. And it's like, I don't care if y'all read books or not, this one page is impactful. Y'all need to check it out. But yes, it was a great book.
Yes. Is there another choice?
Yes. I believe it's called A Piece of Cake. I cannot remember her name, but in short, I think it's great, like one of the best books for trauma survivors. I will definitely send you that information after this.
I feel like I've read that too. I should pull up my Goodreads account when I'm talking to people, because I think I read that book too. And I'm just really horrible, either messing up the book title's name or the author. I don't remember details super well, but.
Yes, but I can describe the front of the book all day. Any book, I can tell you what it looks like. I can, yeah, but as far as the author and the names, it can be touch and go. But as far as A Piece of Cake, it talks about, you know, a woman that had all the odds against her as far as, you know, drugs, being sexually abused, being physically abused, foster care, and just the way that she turned it all around is like inspiring. I think I read it in like 3 days as soon as I got home. And again, it goes against what my self-care was, but it's like, I got to figure out what happened to this lady. Like, how did she get out of this? You ever read a book that it seems like a movie, like when you're reading it, that's how you know a book is good. It's like, you're telling people like you saw something on television. No, it's on this paper right here. A piece of paper is just as good as an animated series or whatever that's on television. But that A Piece of Cake was very inspiring. It makes you know that at the end of the day, you know, if you really want to change, if you really want to put that work in, I mean, the opportunities are endless. Yeah, you have to have that desire. Exactly.
Oh, I love that note for us to end on. I mean, unless you have anything else you want to add, you're welcome to. But I mean, I love when we can end on an inspirational note. So if you want to say something else, you got to put a little pizzazz in it. So people feel uplifted as we end up the show today.
No, I agree. I think that's perfect. Like you said, like we said, at the end of the day, you know, just making sure that you live in your best life and you can do what you can to get yourself outside of a rut, just to make sure that you have those support systems out there, however way works for you. It's not one size fits all. But like you said, at the end of the day, if we really want that help, if we really want to do the hard work, it's possible. There's hope out there. And I want to thank you for inviting me.
I wanted to say amen to your last statement. And I'm really appreciative of you coming on today too. I feel a little more inspired as well.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening in today. Please join us next week, same day and time. Also, I would love for you to check out my website, healthrivedream.com.